You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
To Brookings. I'm Helen Hadani, and I'm a fellow with the Center for Universal Education and the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking. I would first like to thank the Bernard Van Leer Foundation and Bob and Ann Bass for their support of the Playful Learning Landscapes Initiative here at Brookings. The Bernard Van Leer Foundation support of the Playful Learning Landscapes Initiative through the Center for Universal Education, and the support of Bob Bass, a trustee of Brookings, and launching the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking makes the work we do here possible. I would also like to reiterate Brookings' commitment to independence and underscore that the views expressed today are solely those of the speakers. And lastly, I would like to thank my many colleagues who helped support this event this morning. This is an event about playful learning. So we're going to start with a very quick activity. On your seats, you should have found a small box of crayons and two index cards. One of the index cards, the small white one, I'd like you to save for later in the event. The big blue index card you're going to use right now. What I want you to do is think back to your childhood and think about what and how you loved to play. But don't think too much because I'm only going to give you about 60 seconds to do this activity. Okay, but first, I'm going to show you my drawing. Okay, so as you can see, my childhood was filled with Hello Kitty. Hello Kitty everything. Okay, so now I want you, now is your turn. Okay, you'll have about 60 seconds to do your drawing. Ready? Go. Okay, hopefully you're pretty much done with your drawing. You can continue later, and also there are baskets at the back. If you would like to leave us your drawing, we would love to have it, okay? We all played as children and hopefully have some very fond memories of playing a favorite board game or card game with our siblings and friends, or maybe an endless game of hide and seek at our grandmother's house. But play is more than fun. It is how we form relationships, how we build core cognitive and social skills, and how we reduce stress. I had countless tea parties with my Hello Kitty dolls and many stuffed animals that I often subjected my two older brothers into partaking in, and I still hear about that to this day. But I also learned some important skills through that play. I learned some important language and social skills and how to divide a pretty pink cake into six equal pieces. I'd like you to now take just a moment, look down at your drawing and think about what did you learn from how you played as a child? Maybe it was learning something about spatial reasoning by building with Lego bricks or doing puzzles. Or maybe you learned something about friction and velocity by building ramps for your matchbox cars. This is the connection between play and learning. Today, I'm here to share a big idea around playful learning. Here at Brookings, we are about capturing, designing, and communicating big ideas to solve complex problems. The Playful Learning Landscapes Initiative at Brookings is a joint venture between the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking and the Center for Universal Education. Working at the intersection of both of these centers, I am leading this initiative and bringing together an interdisciplinary group of scholars and practitioners to transform everyday spaces into powerful and fun learning environments for children and families. But what is the challenge that we are addressing? We have a global learning crisis. Experts predict that by the year 2030, over half of the world's youth, that's over 800 million young people, will not have the skills that they need to succeed in work and their future careers. In high-income countries like the United States, we are failing a third of our children. In the United States, economic disparities among families lead to large gaps in educational outcomes. And achievement gaps between cognitive and social skills of children living in middle-income communities and peers from under-resourced areas emerge as early as age 3. That sets the trajectory for children from under-resourced communities to poor academic outcomes. We know from research that early childhood education is one of the most powerful mechanisms for increasing social mobility and economic opportunity. And policymakers have focused largely on top-down reforms to improve formal education environments, including preschool. But this strategy ignores the 80% of waking time that children spend outside of school with their families. We also know from research that quality child caregiver interactions and communication are a key ingredient and critical to healthy early development. Yet families experiencing poverty have fewer opportunities to engage in these healthy communicative interactions. Low-resourced environments often have low-quality public spaces and public infrastructure, and fewer opportunities for children and families to engage in nurturing learning environments, both formal and informal, including museums and libraries. By addressing educational inequity through a holistic, community-based model, Playful Learning Landscapes sets in motion transformative and structural change at the individual, family, and community levels, and broadens economic opportunity and encourages social mobility. Through fun, interactive installations co-located in spaces that families frequent, including bus stops and supermarkets and libraries, Playful Learning Landscapes encourages the development of critical connections and skills, allowing children from under-resourced communities to enter formal school on a more level playing field and to continue to thrive in school and beyond. And while there is no silver bullet for educational inequity, Playful Learning Landscapes offers a unique and powerful solution with a wide range of outcomes. From a child development perspective, Playful Learning Landscapes enables a mindset shift among caregivers and communities around the role of child caregiver interactions and play in foundational learning. At the same time, Playful Learning Landscapes, from a placemaking perspective, makes cities more beautiful and livable for their residents and engages communities in revitalization of the public realm, transforming vacant lots and bus stops, and providing opportunities for critical social interaction among children and adults alike. So we find ourselves today at a very exciting moment, as there is a growing evidence base and local experiences contributing to the playful learning movement. One recent contribution is a report produced by the Center for Universal Education with support from the William Penn Foundation through Temple University entitled Philadelphia Playful Learning Landscapes: Scaling Strategies for a Playful Learning Movement. For those interested, there are copies at the back for you to take. This report explores Philadelphia's efforts to apply the latest in learning sciences to urban planning and design to improve early outcomes, early developmental and learning outcomes for children and families, especially those living in under-resourced and marginalized communities. With Philadelphia serving as a demonstration site, the report documents efforts to scale playful learning landscapes, installations, and activities, and offers lessons learned to inform further expansion in Philadelphia and other cities and across the world. Some examples of playful learning landscapes installations, a few of these highlighted in the video that you just saw, are Supermarket Speak, which transformed a daily trip to the supermarket into a learning opportunity through simple signage, such as where does milk come from in the dairy section. This promoted caregiver-child interaction and communication, and results found a huge increase in the number of caregiver-child interactions and communication, a 33% jump when the signs were up versus when the signs were down in low-income neighborhoods. And it's important to note that this work has now been replicated in other cities, in laundromats and food pantries. We also have Parkopolis, which enriched a public space, a children's museum, with math and science learning by engaging children and their caregivers in a life-size board game where children roll fraction dice and move 1.5 or 2¾ spaces. Results found that 39% more children used whole number language and 12% more children used fraction number language when engaging in Parkopolis compared to another STEM exhibit. And then we have Urban Thinkscape, which transformed a vacant lot next to a bus stop into a play space infused with learning science by adding puzzles to the back of a bench and transforming the childhood hopscotch game into an executive function activity. Urban Thinkscape has shown significant increases in quality child caregiver interactions, also an increase in the number of caregivers using language around letters and numbers and colors, from just over 2% at pretest to 36% at post-test, as well as heightened community pride and civic engagement. At its core, playful learning landscapes involves co-creation with the community. Community leaders and neighborhood businesses co-design, develop, and maintain playful learning landscapes installations. Playful learning landscapes installations, including Urban Thinkscape, saw researchers work with community members to design evaluations of the projects that met the community's needs and goals. The Philadelphia report concludes with a call to action on how to move beyond supporting the replication of a single installation to shaping mainstream practices of government, businesses, and other organizations to incorporate playful learning principles into their own work. The call to action centers around three general areas. The first is generating evidence about playful learning to continue to build the evidence base, including developing shared metrics across Playful Learning Landscapes initiatives. Secondly, to capture and codify key elements and approaches to implementing playful learning initiatives. Evidence about what is working and how it is working is critical for transforming cities into vibrant learning communities. And thirdly, to build a coordinated global movement around playful learning, with a central hub to coordinate efforts, connect partners, and share the learning across various sites, cities across the world can collectively pool their resources, their skills, and their expertise to develop family-friendly cities. The report was informed by many of you here today, including data from pilot installations from Philadelphia and a number of other cities, as well as additional background research about relevant efforts to scale playful initiatives that have led to widespread changes in learning outcomes for children and families. Our intention is that the findings and the lessons learned from the report will feed into many of the discussions today. And I just want to, before I close, highlight one of my favorite quotes about building family-friendly cities. Children are a kind of indicator species. If we can build a successful city for children, we will have a successful city for all people. So I'd next like to give you a quick preview of the rest of the morning's events so you know what's up and coming. We're excited to have two panel sessions led by my colleagues, Jennifer Vey and Rebecca Winthrop. Rebecca's panel will take a deep dive into the connection between play and learning and how early learning can be fostered through play and child caregiver interactions. That will be followed by Jennifer's panel, which will explore the promise of public spaces for promoting learning through play and ways of measuring the impact at multiple levels. After the two panels, we are very honored to have Francis Bronnet, the president of the Pratt Institute, give our keynote address. And then we will have Ralph Smith from the Campaign for Grade Level Reading wrap up with some closing comments. Thank you very much and enjoy the morning.
All right, wonderful. Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much, Helen, for wherever she is, there she is, for kicking us off, giving us the big idea in the overview. I'm Rebecca Winthrop. I'm the co-director here, as Helen said, with the Center for Universal Education. You will soon, in the next panel, hear from my co-conspirator, partner in crime, Jennifer Vey, who directs the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking. Delighted to have join us today Greg Baer, who's the executive director of the Grable Foundation, Joan Lombardi, who is, her title here is director of early opportunities, but I must say she has a very long career with many other titles that are not featured here, including a distinguished career at the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, leading early childhood for the nation, and working with many different initiatives and foundations on this topic. And last but not least, the sort of mother of playful learning landscapes, if I can say that, Kathy, is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, who we're very lucky to have with us here at Brookings as a senior fellow, but also as a professor at Temple University. So thank you all for being here. And Kathy, I wanted to start with you. Because a lot of what we've had conversations about in terms of big picture things that we care about at the Center for Universal Education is thinking about, you know, are we preparing our young people for the world they will enter as adults? Are we preparing them for the labor market? Where are we preparing them to be good citizens? Are we preparing them to thrive in their personal lives? And we certainly know from lots and lots of literature that the one thing we absolutely have to do is give young people a broad set of competencies and skills. They do need strong academic knowledge, but they absolutely need strong, call whatever term you want. Some people talk about 21st century skills. Some people talk about social emotional learning. We have a list of actually 300 terms, transversal skills, transferable skills, et cetera, but I won't give them all. The point is young people need to have strong analytical experience and strong knowledge, and then they need to know how to learn new things over the course of their life. They need to know how to work with other people, think critically, have empathy for others. And this is something that we talk about as sort of the breadth of skills. And it's certainly something we work a lot on at Brookings within education systems, talking to education systems how they can deliver a breadth of skills to students more effectively. And employers are asking for it on and on with the rising age of automation. We know that 50 to 70% of job tasks, so within jobs, tasks, a lot of tasks will be automated, and everybody will need to do have a lot more higher order thinking skills, whether it's a manual job or a sort of cognitive job. So that's something that's really important, and education systems have to grapple with. But we know from what Helen talked about, that the gap is so huge and the pace of change is so long and slow that we absolutely have to find any good idea out there that we haven't yet tapped to try to advance closing this gap. In the U.S., the pace of change is so slow between rich kids and poor kids. It's about, on average, 126 years for poor kids to catch up with rich kids in the United States. It's going to take 126 years for just basic school readiness indicators. And, you know, so we've got an urgent crisis on our hand. And this is part of why we are really excited about this idea of unlikely allies between the placemaking and urban planning community and the early childhood development community. And so one of the things, Kathy, I wanted to start with you on, you in the presentation, Helen featured much of your research and much of the sort of installations that you've been experimenting and playing with for years to see, are there other ways for us to sort of nudge the type of caregiver-child interaction we know is really crucial? And I wanted you to talk just a little bit about two things and explain to the audience why playful learning landscapes works. So from a child developmental psychologist, one is this idea of play. Like what, I'm not a play specialist, and I have determined that there's no one definition of play that they all agree on, but that there is a continuum of play that everyone agrees on. On one side, there's free play, kids just going out in the street, playing around, doing whatever they want. On the other end of the spectrum is very structured games. And somewhere in the middle is guided play, which is where playful learning landscape sits. Tell us about why is guided play so important for helping close this big gap?
Sure. Well, thank you, and thank you all for being here today. I also just want to point out that my partner in crime, Roberta Golenkoff, is here in the audience today, and we've done everything together for like 40 years, so she needs to be acknowledged too. So what I think we've learned in the science are several key foundations. The first foundation is that we're getting a much better handle on how human beings learn. And they learn, you could even put this in a tweet, right? They learn when they're doing something active, when they're engaged, not distracted, when something's meaningful rather than disjointed, when it's socially interactive, and believe it or not, when it's joyful. Now, let's try to figure out what in the world includes those features. And it turned out that much of what we were doing in school was the antithesis of active, engaged, meaningful, socially interactive, and joyful. So how did we turn that around? And the other thing that we realized is that there really are a suite of skills that you need. We went down a rabbit hole, and the rabbit hole was kind of, oh my gosh, we better make sure that kids just do well, and notice the just there, in their math outcomes when we give them a standardized test. We don't even really know sometimes what we're testing. And when we give them a math test. So the question that we had to ask ourselves is, what do you really call success as a society? And what are those suite of skills? And what we figured out at some point from, again, the evidence-based point of view, is that a lot of the suite of skills appears in the sandbox and takes you all the way to the boardroom. Now the question is, how do you best deliver that? And one thought in early education was that the best way to deliver it was let the kids play. And so you ended up with this war going on between the play schools and the direct instruction, sometimes known by the other camp as drill and kill, where the play group was called the superfluous group or the just play group. All right. So as we looked at the evidence, we thought, my gosh, there has to be another way. There has to be a way that we can offer rich curricular goals and at the same time do so with a pedagogical approach that is active and engaged, meaningful, socially interactive, and joyful. Ta-da! So we looked at the continuum of play, and instead of just talking about go out into the playground and you will come back as a reader, we thought it might be a better idea to have a learning goal in mind, whether it's the museum type where you structure an environment where the kids kind of fall into with their parents. Notice the two gen here, where they fall into doing things that are going to support that, or be the guide on the side where you're kind of prompting and nudging on the side. You put all that together, and playful learning landscape seemed like the natural way to do what we call guided play, which is that play in the middle, allowing the kids to be the agent of their own learning in a richly based environment. And there you've sort of cut it in half, and you said we can do both.
Fantastic. So another sort of follow-up question for you about why, so that explains the sort of why playful learning landscapes, as it's structured and designed, gets to the guide to play and the outcomes you want. Could you tell us a little bit about why changing caregiver-child interaction is so important, and how does playful learning landscapes do that exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to use an example to help out here because I think it makes it so clear. Let's take reading. What we often do to enhance reading is we go after phonics right away, and we teach lists of vocabulary words. Think SAT. Remember when you sat down and learned the word syzygy? Never to be remembered again? Okay. Now,
I never learned that word.
Yeah. You can look it up later. All right. So anyway, the problem with that is that it doesn't stick. And when it doesn't stick, it doesn't transfer. And when we look at learning in the scientific literature, we look for stickiness and we look for transfer. So the question was, how do you learn to read? Well, it turns out in learning to read, you kind of start with communication. And when you have, with collaboration and relationships. And with those relationships, you start to get a back and forth. In fact, the scientific evidence that's growing on these relationships and the importance of the back and forth dynamic, many of you have probably heard of this as serve and return, but we call it a conversational duet because it's serve and return and return and return and return, that it actually creates brain structure, all right? And when you know that, then you're building the communication of language. So collaboration or relationships builds communication. If you have strong language skills, then you're not learning isolated words for an SAT test. You're learning them in context. And when you learn them in context, you actually hold on to them and you have a rich knowledge base so that when you learn those words, they make sense. And that way, you're going to become a real reader because the reading is based on something. So even something as simple as reading works that way. But there's tons of evidence now. In fact, a recent report that just came out from Kim Noble's lab shows that the gap that we have seen in reading over the years can be fully accounted for. Imagine this, fully accounted for by the kinds of conversations you had with your family so many years before. Unbelievable.
And that's why the nudging, and some people think of when I describe this to them, if say, oh, it's like behavioral economics, like it's a nudging. That's why placing a design of a physical environment nudges this sort of increased quantity and quality of language.
That's exactly
right. And that's
right.
Why it's important. Okay.
Right. And I just want to say that you can target it. So if we put things out in the environment that is more STEM-like, science, technology, engineering, and math, what do we get? STEM language. What do we know? If you use more STEM language, then go on a few years, and the research tells us that prepares you for school readiness.
Okay, great. I want to turn to you, Joan and Greg. Now that we have sort of a better understanding of like how this actually works, can you bring us up a level and tell us, because both of you have done quite a bit of programmatic initiatives across jurisdictions, how does this Playful Learning Landscapes initiative fit in with, you know, the range of other types of child-friendly initiatives at community level that's happening?
Great. Well, thank you, Rebecca. And it's great to see everyone here, so many friends. I want to thank you first and your whole team for shining a spotlight on not just the 20%, but the 80% of time when children are learning. I wanted to reinforce that concept. It's what we call surround sound learning, because you're learning all the time and those concepts are being reinforced. And Kathy, thank you so much for the words guided play and the research that you're doing. When I entered the field many years ago, as you noted, there was this big debate between play and direct instruction. I thought it was over. And then a few years ago, just like 2 years ago, a reporter called me and said, "What's your position on play versus academics?" And I thought, here we are again. And I think what you're doing here is really finding that middle, that it's not either or, that children are learning all the time, and that it affects their development holistically. I wondered what people wrote about what you learned when you were playing. From me, I was climbing trees, I learned independence, I learned initiative, and I think those social skills, those emotional skills really stayed with me. I also just want to note the importance of caregiver-child interaction. How many of us have been on the playground with our child when they say, "Mommy, look at me," or "Daddy, look at me"? That's an amazing opportunity for us to reinforce how important they are, how to respond to what they're doing, and to really be intentional about extending that learning. So I just wanted to reinforce some of those concepts. Turn into the community, and Greg and I have spent a lot of time talking about this. We both work a lot with communities. What I'm seeing across the United States is just amazing. The great work is happening at the local level, whether you're in Alameda County or in Onondaga County, whether you're in Palm Beach or Lincoln, Nebraska, or Detroit, Michigan, or whether you're in Siaya County, Kenya, or Bogota, Colombia. There is a movement happening where people are coming together and saying, how can we be the best place to raise a child? And how can we look at how children are learning and how they're doing, how they're developing at birth, at 3, at 5, and then eventually how they're doing in the early grades of school and beyond? What's exciting to me about Playful Learning Landscapes is that we need to enjoin it with that movement that's already going on at the community level. And because it does two things. One, when you have what you saw in Philadelphia, it's a metaphor for what's going on in the community and how they care for young children. It brings people's attention to the needs of young children and how they learn. Secondly, and this is the advocate speaking, it brings on new champions, architects, urban designers, people that think differently than the traditional early childhood people. And together, I think they can be champions for young children, and that's what we want.
Great. Greg, thoughts?
First, I feel so lucky to be here. I feel like I'm amongst and between three luminaries, all of whom just gave us a masterclass. So if anyone ever has felt imposter syndrome,
Get over it. You are fine.
So I come from the other side of the state in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, which is Fred Rogers' hometown. And Fred Rogers taught us, and his legacy reminds us, that play is the real work of childhood. Pittsburgh is a place we like to call Kidsburgh, and have that aspiration to be one of the best places on planet Earth to be a kid, and made easier to be a parent. And when I think about the playful design of playful learning spaces, I think about moments. How many of you have a child or have a child in your life? And you think about the moments in those kids' lives. Think of birthdays. Kids talk about their birthdays about 11 months in advance of their next birthday. Well, think about these playful learning spaces. They create moments. They create remarkably special moments for kids together with a parent or an adult that makes learning visible. It makes learning visible and playful and joyful at a bus stop, at a supermarket, at a crosswalk, in a museum, in a library. And that expression, that public expression, is a public expression of our commitment to kids. It's why, Helen, I love that quotation from the mayor in South America, that kids are sort of an indicator species, right? Because if we create an environment, and an environment drives a behavior of a commitment to kids, and that learning happens anytime, any place, well, that happens in our schools, it happens in our museums, and it happens in our libraries, but it happens in our public spaces. And if we take the moments to design those public spaces that create those moments for an adult and a child, then we have made that commitment to children and youth in the way that we need to.
And I have a follow-up question for you, Greg, and then also, Joan, I'd like you to pitch in. I mean, I teased you a moment ago, don't be silly, you absolutely belong here, in part because I want to pivot to the policy realm, which is where you've been an absolute leader, particularly in Pittsburgh and in the surrounding jurisdictions. So if we think this is a good idea, if we think this really is going to help young people, you know, how do we get more attention, get communities to start focusing on the other 80%, not in any way to say don't keep focusing on the schools, but like how do we galvanize that other 80%? What types of policies do we need? What types of public campaigns do we need? You've really done that. Can you tell us what have been the big strategies? What have been your lessons learned? And then, Joan, I'd be interested to hear your perspective also.
Well, I think the playful learning landscapes happens in a place where we do the unsexy work of a lot of systems building. So when I think about Pittsburgh, when I think about Kidsburgh, there's been decades of work of building a quality early learning system, decades of work of building an out-of-school time system, looking to Boston, Providence, other cities as examples, decades of building a mentoring system. In the past 15 years, we've built a network called Remake Learning, which is a network of more than 600 schools, museums, libraries, early learning centers, creative industries, higher education, thinking about and collectively working on what is relevant, what is engaging, what is joyful, what is equitable as we think about creating a learning environment in all the places where kids learn. People like to say learning anywhere, anytime, and any pace. It's that, quite frankly, it's the year in, year out work that happens in building a community of relationships among adults who are then positioned, because they're superintendents, because they're architects, because they're designers, because they're librarians, to think about learning experiences, whether it's a space or curriculum or professional learning, to think differently about how we're supporting and capturing learning opportunities for young people.
And some people might not know about Remake Learning. Can you just describe it? And perhaps your Remake Learning Weeks and, you know, whatever features of it you want to describe.
I appreciate that. So it is this 15-year-old network. So what is Remake Learning? If you're a school superintendent or you're a librarian, there are grants you can apply to. There are meetups every month. There are conference delegations. We just took 20 superintendents to San Diego. There'll be 67 people going to South by Southwest in Austin next month. It creates a community of adults who have access to communications, resources, et cetera, to create these learning environments. Now, it serves educators and practitioners. And so we've worked hard to say, how do we connect with parents, families, and caregivers and help them understand the importance of the learning sciences and how the learning sciences are built into these learning environments? And if, in fact, my kid is lit up by playful learning or by making or technology-enhanced learning, how do I support my child? So 5 years ago, launched something called Remake Learning Days. It's a lot like the Ultimate Block Party that is featured well in the Philadelphia Report. Taking a region and thinking of it as a learning campus, there are more than 250 events over the course of 9 days in Pittsburgh during which parents, families, and caregivers can experience how learning is being remade and how to support their child in these contemporary learning moments and environments. And this work has now spread such that 15 cities across America, from Washington, D.C. to San Diego, will be hosting Remake Learning Days this upcoming late April and May.
Great. So, Joan, I want to go to you, particularly if you could lean in a bit on the policy angle, on sort of like how can we get this movement going? How do we shift the attention? How do we help scale some of these approaches? And then as a heads up to the audience, after we get wisdom from Joan, we'll go to the floor with some Q&A.
Well, I think the wisdom is already in the communities. There is a movement out there to focus on, at least on the young children's side. I think what you're talking about is going on in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, something about Pennsylvania, I think is happening. We need playful policymakers, I think, and this is an area that I think they can get excited about, that may be more playful and joyful and therefore lead to policy change. That's, I think, our hope. But we have to be intentional about it. We have to get them involved, but we have to get parents involved. And I think what you're doing to involve parents in the simplest way to help design, create, and react to what where the urban planners are doing, I think is going to be critical to changing policy. As you mentioned, I've been in the field for many decades. I am really now focused more and more on the resources that we need to really deliver on the promise that we've made to young children, that we will be encouraging them at the early years so that they have a lifelong trajectory of health, learning, and behavior. But we're not going to do that without enough resources. And that is the key policy issue, I think, of the day. Early childhood has been financed from the federal level and the state level. We're starting to get more local resources. This is a way to make it visible and to make those needs more apparent.
And I know, give us just a smattering before we go to the audience. I know that there's lots of issues that help children thrive in communities. And this is, you know, a particular approach that can really help their development and well-being. But what are some of the other issues we've talked about? Well, sending them out to play when there's terrible air to breathe, that isn't a good recipe. So, you know, what are some of the other issues and how do you think we should approach sort of this broader collaboration?
I think we have to address these issues systemically, and that means children have a right to play, but they have a right to play in clean air, in fresh air. And what we're seeing around the world is exactly the opposite. When you have to test the quality of the air before you'll even let your children outside, when you can't drink the water in your own home. So we have to enjoin this issue of playful learning with an environmental movement, with a need for public housing, all the things that affect young children holistically, because this alone won't do it. It's more complex than that.
Great. So let's go to some questions. We have a question right here. Two questions. We'll take these two and then come back to the panel and then take another set. And please do introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Loretta Goodwin. I'm with the American Youth Policy Forum here in D.C. Two quick questions for Kathy. I wonder if you can talk a little about student voice and listening to the young people. And I know you're primarily dealing with probably younger kids, but just a little bit more about how we're actually hearing from them what they need. And then on the policy side, what we do is put together learning events for policymakers, take them around and show them innovative practices. So I'm curious, when you say playful policymakers, can you talk a little bit about ways that you think that we can get to that and showcasing for them? Because I'd be interested in having more of a conversation with you about that.
Wonderful. Thanks. So a question for Kathy and then a question about how to create playful policymakers. There's in the back here with the red sweater. Yes.
Good morning. My name is Karima Ahmed. I am with Goddard Systems. My question is for Joan surrounding policy. So it's awesome to want to create fun policymakers or playful policymakers, but what areas of funding do you suggest that advocates target when reaching for dollars to fund playful learning landscapes?
All right. Kathy, let's start with you, and we'll go straight down the panel.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you so much for asking your question. One of the things that we've spent a lot of time doing in Playful Learning Landscapes is getting community voices. And those voices are really the whole gambit. We first visit the community and say, what is it you're looking for? And we got pretty clear answers from community members. They wanted a place that was safe. They wanted a place that was beautiful. They asked us if it was possible to do something where their children might want to stay in their neighborhood as opposed to flee it. So we pulled together from what they suggested. I mean, the science is as the science is, but we can adapt that. It can look like anything, and it can fit any cultural niche. And that's what's so exciting about Playful Learning Landscapes. It doesn't have just one cookie cutter form or shape. It really is adaptable. Parkopolis, for example, is in Spanish as well as in English. And in Philadelphia, I think, 13% of our population is now Latino. So we're very conscious of that. And these members of the community showed up, and I'm telling you, really, everyone. We had teenagers, we had older people in the community, we had younger kids in the community that showed up at our community meeting, and they gave us ideas about how to tweak what we were doing and even made suggestions about how we could do it better. I loved that. And we listened to them and we heard them. So it's built into the design of how we move forward. And I know in the Playful Learning Action Network that we're putting together to try to reach out to communities, that's a core feature. The second is that one of the projects that we did in Philadelphia was also called Play Streets, and we did it with the school system as well. And it was amazing. It was with teenagers who were working with young kids. Now, you might wonder, oh my God, recipe for disaster, right? No, the teens loved playing, and we actually put them through training, just like you would a camp counselor, okay? So these teens came to our training. They learned how to engage in playful learning. Did they do it perfectly? Probably not. But at least they had the training, and they felt like they had agency and worth over the summer with kids. It occupied their time and it occupied the kids' time, and there was some place to go. So it's one of the core features.
Great. Thanks. Joan, question on policy.
Well, you know, as you were talking, Kathy, I was thinking about how you're bringing the generations together, teens working on behalf of young children, giving them voice. I think that's all part of the policymaking. Yeah, I'd like to see more intergenerational linkages. We've got a lot of elder care who need also to be part of this playful learning. So, you know, I think it's bringing people together. Politicians come where people come. And so if you've got a gathering like that, it attracts, I think, the interest of policymakers. But honestly, I think it's a twofer. It's not only that children are learning, interacting with caregivers, but it's a portal to other issues. It's a doorway to talk about the fact that we need resources for better programming, for caregiver salaries, for better health care for children. So to me, it's both something for children, something for parents and families and communities, but a doorway to larger issues that also need to be talked about.
All right. How do we get playful policymakers? This is what everyone wants to know, Greg.
Yes. So, so Pittsburgh is also home to the Pittsburgh Steelers, and we have stolen all sorts of ideas from Philadelphia and AYPF. And look, it's tried and true community organizing, right? Putting together publications like If Kids Build a City and making sure those are widely distributed at Institute of Politic events held at the University of Pittsburgh or through the Pittsburgh Business Times. It's during Remake Learning Days, mapping out the events by legislative district and then organizing special tours for staff and policymakers to go see these spaces and places and experiences. It's a lot of just tried and true community organizing. And when we think about Remake Learning Days, yes, part of the goal is about supporting parents, families, and caregivers and helping them understand how they can support the children in their lives. But it's also about building parent demand. So when those parents go to a school board meeting or a meeting with legislators or writing op-eds or letters to the editor, they're asking questions like, why don't we have this in our neighborhood? Well, couldn't we think about this differently? And the exact money, you go to the Department of Public Works, you go to Parks and Rec, you think about those human services contracts with out-of-school time organizations. There are all sorts of creative ways to use existing public dollars, to say nothing of corporate or philanthropic dollars, to make these things happen.
Before we turn back to the audience for a question or two, Joan, you're a former policymaker. Were those all the strategies you needed? Do you have other strategies? You come prepackaged to be playful. We know that. But what other strategies would work on you or your colleagues?
You know, I think that what Greg said about making these things visible so that other neighborhoods see and get interested in that. I think the more we talk about it, the more we showcase other cities and other communities, and I would say rural areas as well as cities, I think that helps build a movement. And it takes time, and it takes persistence. And it takes a bringing people together. This is a bipartisan issue. And I'm hoping that at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level, this is something that we can all rally behind, and it's a unifying movement for the country.
Yes, Kathy.
Can I just add one quick thing? Which is, there's another piece to this, I think, which is that a lot of people want to be playful, but they're kind of afraid. And they don't see or know about the links between play and learning. So in New Hampshire, they just passed a bill that all kindergartens next year must be playful learning kindergartens. Go New Hampshire. And that's because they finally saw the links between playful learning and outcomes. And it's that kind of stuff that also makes a difference.
And just to do a quick double down on that, because your question about how do we get policymakers to see this, one of the big research initiatives we have here at the Center for Universal Education is really about the science of scaling proven ideas. And there's a whole bunch of research we've done around things that have been effective at that, and we have this list of kind of 14 ingredients that more or less are key. And one of them is good use of evidence. And what we have found is that very rigorous evidence is useful for the practitioners. We need to know what works, what doesn't work in design. It actually doesn't make always that big a difference for policymakers. The thing that you often gets them turned on is going, visiting, seeing for themselves, and getting involved in an activity where they too learn through experiential learning. And they start, you know, doing a playful learning exercise and people are pointing out to them how kids are learning. We found that that type of experiential learning is a different type of evidence, but equally powerful. All right, questions. We have one here. Okay, if you can be very rapid, we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we'll have 1 minute responses from everybody.
Michael Yarlin, I'm a pediatrician. I just want to emphasize the importance of playful learning in mitigating stress. Stress is such a, talk about a thing that's going to drive policymakers. There's a mental health crisis in this country. When we have a high suicide rate in 10 and 11-year-olds, and play is one of the best antidotes to this kind of huge stress in our society.
Great. Thank you. You are a model citizen for question. Yeah. So we have 1, 2, We're going to get everybody. You just have to be really brief.
Hi, my name is Kamsi McAdams, and I'm a mother of a toddler here in D.C., and I'm also the Global Director for STEM Curriculum at Discovery Education. So personally, I want to know if there's any efforts going on in D.C. That you could tell us about. And professionally, I build curriculum for the country of Egypt, so I'm wondering whether there's any efforts happening in the MENA region that you could share about, and if not quickly in a panel, maybe afterwards.
Absolutely. Great idea. And then we had, yes, the middle, and then the last one here.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Steve Preston. I'm with the Parks and People Foundation in Baltimore. And, you know, it's no new news that Baltimore had the most violent year last year on record. One question I have for you is, have you seen this work help reduce violence in your cities, particularly Philadelphia, Pittsburgh? I think Baltimore and Philadelphia are pretty comparable. Because ultimately, Greg, you talked about asking Rec and Parks. Our Rec and Parks budget 60% of what it was 50 years ago, and now we have to cut it 5% more to meet the Kerwin Commission. So it's hard to tell policymakers about this stuff, even though I think it's a great idea, with you know, sort of violence at the top of everyone's mind.
Anxiety, violence, global. Yes, please.
Have anyone involved police in the communities? I think that's an untapped resource for four or five different reasons.
Great. So 1 minute, both answering the question and then any closing thoughts. We'll start this way. Greg, you first, and we'll go the other way. Yeah.
Michael, I think about what you just said about the environment. My Pittsburgh colleague, Bill Strickland, says all the time, environment drives behavior. Look, there are ultimately 97 solutions to the types of things that we're discussing here. But creating that built environment that contributes to a sensibility about the types of investments, the types of behaviors, the types of experiences we need to create for children and their parents, families, and caregivers is something that will then contribute. And I don't know that I can draw a straight line between this work and violence reduction. I'm not a social scientist. If I pretended to be one, I think that would be dangerous. but I do know, and I know enough from qualitative and quantitative research, that it contributes to an environment that is fundamentally different and suggests different types of investments in places like DC or Egypt that I'll defer to my other colleagues about.
Great, thank you, Joan.
Well, I want to also reinforce what you said, Michael, about stress. I mean, one of the more upsetting things that I see happening across the country is when they're reducing outside playtime for children in the early grades, which is the exact opposite of what they should be doing. So I'm heartened by New Hampshire, but I think we have to send that message. Children are stressed, even very young children we're seeing stressed, and this is part of the answer to reducing that stress level. We should have a conversation later about the MENA region, and we can talk more about interest there. And, you know, I think one of the points that you're bringing up about violence and violence reduction, too many guns in too many cities in the United States, is that this is a hopeful sign in those communities. Again, I don't know how direct the evidence is. I'll turn to Kathy for that. But this is a way to answer that. But we have to make those neighborhoods safe. Otherwise, parents aren't going to be willing to bring their children to play in these outside spaces. And so these bigger issues go hand in hand with this, including controlling the number of guns we have across the United States.
Thank you, Joan. Okay, Kathy.
Amen,
one,
Joan.
1 minute.
Okay. 1 minute.
Word.
Thank you, Michael Yagman. I just want to introduce him because he's the person who brought you the prescription for play that many of you might have heard of last year. So absolutely on stress reduction. I don't know of anything in D.C. or Egypt, but I will tell you that there's a lot of interest from around the country and around the world. I think there's maybe 10, 15 cities in the U.S. and maybe 10 from around the world. We can talk later about what they are, but please talk to us. And on violence, what we have right now in evidence is the proof of concept. What we need to do next, I think, is to try to get enough of these things in a neighborhood where you can show the dose and density. I think another really exciting place to go next is to work in child care centers so that you have sort of a central core and can put a number of these elements, and in low-income housing, where you can literally change the environment for people to make it a kinder, gentler environment. I will say this, though. Urban ThinkScape has now been up for 2.5 years in an area of Philadelphia, which is a very poor city, as many of you know, in an area where you would normally see tons of graffiti, and it should have been ruined by now. But because of the community involvement, because the community owns this, not us, there's not a drop of graffiti anywhere, and the neighborhood is proud of it and wants to keep it going. That seems to me to be precisely what we need to do so that it can be repurposed for the people who help us think through what it should look like. And I love the idea of working with the police as well, Bear.
Great. Thank you so much. I would just say in final closing that from where we sit at Brookings, which is sort of the bird's eye view, and our role in all of this is to drive policy-related research, to map what's happening, to help bring people together, spark a movement. We're seeing that actually there's a growing ecosystem of organizations that our communities can call, parks departments can call, you can call and ask about, you know, we're doing curriculum in Egypt. And some of them are existing organizations like the Project for Public Spaces and Kaboom and Urban 95 that are leaning in on the learning sciences and the playful learning landscape approaches and bringing them into their work. Some of them are new organizations like the one Kathy referenced, the Playful Learning Landscape Action Network, which is just getting going. So we're very encouraged that there's groups out there, a growing ecosystem that is developing. And we really look forward to having everyone stay in touch. And lastly, Kathy, what was that vocabulary word and what does it mean? Am I the only one who has no idea?
Don't you want to know? I believe it's an alignment of planets or something like that. But the point is, you can learn it
we know the
a
point.
Million times and you still forget it because it doesn't relate to anything.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, good morning, everyone. And thank you so much for being here. We've been prepping for this for some time, so it's just really, really exciting to see so many of you here this morning who are interested in this kind of work. So I'm Jennifer Vey. I'm a senior fellow here at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings, and I'm the director of the Antti and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking, which we launched back in November of 2018, so we're relatively new here at Brookings. So the mission of the center is to inspire public and private and civic sector leaders to make transformative place investments that help generate widespread social and economic benefits. And so I think you can already see from the conversation we've had so far how this really aligns with this work around playful learning landscapes. And so actually, this is pretty unique. It's a really unique partnership that brings this the Bass Center's expertise on placemaking and inclusive economic development together with the expertise of the Center for Universal Education on the Learning Sciences, with the goal, really, as you've heard, of transforming our everyday places into learning opportunities for families and for children. So the last panel focused a fair bit on those early learning aspects of play. And playful learning. And what we're going to do here is kind of shift gears just a little bit to really start to dig into how these efforts and interventions with playful learning landscapes can help revitalize public spaces, can help generate community ownership that Kathy mentioned, and pride, can spur social interaction both among kids and their caregivers, but also among adults by bringing them together in these spaces. And ultimately, really just create more vibrant and family-friendly communities. So first, I'm going to introduce our panels, and then we're going to get going into what I think is going to be a pretty robust discussion. So I have here on my left Nidhi Gulati, who's a Senior Director for Programs and Projects at Project for Public Spaces in New York City. She is a trained architect and an urban researcher who has been with PPS since about 2013. And in that capacity, and you'll get to hear a little bit more about this today, she's worked on more than 20 projects across the U.S. and abroad. We have Elliot Weinbaum, who's a program director at the William Penn Foundation, where he works with a team that supports efforts to improve teaching and learning from early childhood through high school. And William Penn, again, is a supporter of CUE and this event, so thank you, Elliot. And Sarah Siplak is the director of the Playful Pittsburgh Collaborative, which is a group of organizations that are dedicated to advancing the importance of play in the lives of children, families, and communities in the Pittsburgh region. And she and her husband are also in a band called Rec Kids, which I wish that I could somehow weave that into this conversation here. So if you can find a way to work it in, please do so, because I'm dying to know, and we might have to talk later. All right. So at the end of the presentation, of Helen's presentation, she quoted the Mayor Enrique Peñalosa of Bogota, who said, "Children are a kind of indicator species. If we build a successful city for children, we will have a successful city for all people." So I'm going to start with Sarah. Can you give us some examples of how the Playful Pittsburgh Collaborative is working to make Pittsburgh a successful city for children? And how might the ambitions of playful learning landscapes really fit into that work that you're doing?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you for having us here from Pittsburgh. I specifically am very excited to be learning about everything that's going on. And it's really going to help us moving forward, thinking about how we do the work that we do. So the Playful Pittsburgh Collaborative has been around for around 8 years. And it started really as kind of a brainchild between three entities, which I think speaks so much to this idea of placemaking and collaboration, hence the name, the Collaborative. So Trying Together, which is actually where my work is housed, the work of the Playful Pittsburgh Collaborative is housed, is an early childhood advocacy organization. So Kara Simonillo, who's our executive director, it was her conversation with the director of education at the Carnegie Museum of Art, and then the director of education at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. So really these three entities who had their own buckets of work that they were doing, who came together, had this conversation around play through the work that they were doing, and this idea was born to kind of foster this idea of play within a community and how there are so many different organizations that have different work that they are doing and how they all really relate to play and community building. And so the organization has grown significantly over the years. We're up to about 20 organizations that all do very varying degrees of work within their communities. And so we come together to advocate for play, to really, our mission is really to raise awareness, to educate decision makers, and to model and inspire. So we really have done a lot of work in bringing communities together through an annual Ultimate Play Day, which really came out of this idea of the Ultimate Block Party. How can we bring communities together and organizations that are already working within those communities on behalf of families and children, and have a day of play that focuses on why play is important and why caregiver-child interaction is so important in the world of play. And then the big project that I think ties so nicely into what we're talking about today is the concept of the Hazelwood Play Trail. Hazelwood is a community in Pittsburgh that was identified as one neighborhood that was a play desert. And so when Kaboom came in many years ago to talk about this idea, or to actually implement putting playgrounds into, I think it was 10 communities originally, but really the Play Collaborative came together, and there was this mindset of how can we think about building community and play so that it doesn't have to be based specifically on building playgrounds? How can we build a community that is playful and that thinks about play along the way and how we are, how our lives are shaped by play? And so this concept is a work in progress, and it's something that we are hoping to learn more about as we move forward on how we can replicate this in other communities and help communities think about why play is important and how it can change how they view their own community and their own neighborhoods. And so much of what was discussed on this first panel really brought to mind the work that we've been doing in Hazelwood, including bringing in, oh, I think he left, but the gentleman who asked about police officers, they have a chess program that they do, the Pittsburgh Police. And so we've partnered with them to do different work in the community. And so really this idea of how can we bring all these different entities together, the member organizations range from Age-Friendly Greater Pittsburgh, which works with the aging population, All for All, which is an immigrant and refugee advocacy organization. They all are at the table at the Play Collaborative because they inherently understand why play is important, how play is a connector, and how it can help to build community. So we are really looking at how can we build play through the existing organizations that are in our city, in Pittsburgh. And really, Playful Learning Landscapes opens up the door for us to think a little bit more about how we can learn from what is happening. What are the outcomes that are happening through the work that we're doing? It's not something that we have had the resources to really do up to this point. And now we're starting to think about, well, if we want to grow this, if we want this to grow and change, we need to find partners out there who are already doing this work and who can help us define this a little bit more.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. That was really, really helpful. Elliot, we're going to move across the state. Can you talk about Philadelphia's efforts to create a more playful city and give some specific examples of some of the projects that the William Penn Foundation has funded? And as you're thinking about this and understanding that both are important, to what extent are the projects that you've been involved in about play versus playful learning? And what does that kind of spectrum look like?
Sure, yeah, thanks, Jen. So for us, this playful learning initiative fits within a broader set of strategies, right? We are looking at supporting teachers, we are looking at supporting parents and other adult family members in a variety of ways, and to Joan's point, ensuring that the resources are there to make the kinds of public investments that are needed in all of these spaces to support two goals in particular that the foundation has. One is kindergarten readiness, and the other is third grade reading. So for us, the learning, defined broadly to Kathy's point, the kindergarten readiness, it includes vocabulary, it includes letter recognition, but it also includes what you want to call social emotional skills, 21st century skills, the six C's, etc. And so we're constantly thinking about the role of playful learning in building those skills. And I would say the investments that the city, we and the others in the city have been making fall into maybe three categories. There are the big infrastructure investments, and you saw Urban Thinkscape being a key example of that. Some of the infrastructure that the library has been creating within branches. Those are large structural investments that really do stimulate and encourage the kinds of interaction that we know build the brain, build vocabulary, build a whole range of skills. So that's one big category. Another is a lighter touch. Some of the signage that you saw in supermarket speak or talk it up, that exists in supermarkets, it exists in laundromats, it exists in public spaces. That's a lighter touch, but also demonstrates or has encouraged the kinds of interaction that we know is necessary. And the third, I would say, is programming, animating public spaces with activities that are accessible to all and engage young children and often their families in learning opportunities that are fun. Something that the city has called play streets, for example. Kathy referenced earlier, hiring teenagers during the summer, closing streets, and creating activities that have a basis in science and early learning is one example. Also involved the Police Athletic League in that, to the earlier question, along with free library branches, Boys and Girls Clubs, and others to build the community around that playful work. Recently, I learned from Junlei Lee, who's at Harvard and at Simple Interactions Institute, this essential question, right? How does this fill in the blank policy, installation, program, practice help to encourage, enrich, and empower human interaction around and with children, right? And so that's sort of the guiding question for us in many of our investments. How do we encourage, enrich, and empower that interaction that we know is so important for learning?
Great. So you talked about activating public spaces, and certainly Project for Public Spaces has done a lot of that over the years, working in and importantly with communities and with neighborhoods across the globe on projects to reimagine and reinvent public spaces with really a focus on improving physical and social and emotional and ecological health and well-being of communities. So, Nidhi, can you talk about how the community engagement piece is really central to your work and how that approach aligns with the mission and the values of Playful Learning Landscapes?
Right. Absolutely. First of all, thank you, everyone. Talk about imposter syndrome. I'm going to take a second. For those of you who don't know Project for Public Spaces, we're a planning and design nonprofit. We're based in New York City. We've been in existence for 43 years. And as a nonprofit, our mission is to create a world where every person has a say in how their public spaces are designed, with a direct through line to how their community gets strengthened. So with that in mind, we believe very strongly that public spaces that are created with and for the community's unique needs are in fact then unique, and then they lend themselves to like tremendous benefits to the social, physical, and economic sort of capital of the community. So with that in mind, every project that we work on has a very strong community engagement component to it. Because what better way to understand what is it that makes that community unique and what are their unique opportunities and challenges than to go and ask that community and try to understand with them what it is that makes them unique. So we try to do that through all the projects that we work on. We always modify our approach for community engagement, understanding the level of access that that community has and the unique ways in which the community wants to be engaged, because not everybody likes that sit-down meeting. Not everybody likes to have a focus group or an interview and things like that. So understanding the unique needs and access that people have to information, to community engagement, and responding with a community engagement strategy that reflects those needs. The benefit of that, there are many, as you pointed out. You know, we get public spaces that are unique. We get communities that are engaged. We get the opportunity to build stewardship and ownership from the very beginning. So in alignment with Playful Learning Landscapes, that is the opportunity to kind of get the new young people and citizens of the world involved and get them really to be attached to that space, become stewards of the space and things like that. But also, at least from my personal point of view, I think we have a tremendous return in tolerance in the future. You know, we're in 2020, we have incredible inequities in the world, we have incredible divides. So how do we create those bridges between people from different walks of life? Public spaces give us that really that common ground where those bridges can be built, where tolerance can be built. The flip side of that is we could create a space that doesn't account for the community's unique needs. It can be as pretty as possible, as dynamic as possible, but it risks creating that othering. Who is it for? It risks creating distrust in our public processes associated with planning. And it risks basically creating an atmosphere that is not for the community that's there. So community engagement is very important to our work. We try to customize the approach as possible to get customized results. And I see that very prominently aligned with Playful Learning Landscapes, because our world is getting more urban. The number of kids growing up in cities is going to be more and more. So that just basically means in percentages, the percentage of the community that's going to be children and their caregivers is going to be larger. And we will not be able to design public spaces with the community by kind of leaving out a third or more of that community. So I'm very excited.
Great. Thanks. So, Sarah, at the end of your comments, you started to raise a little bit the issue around measurement and outcomes, and I want to pivot to really delve into that a little bit. It certainly came up in some of the questions at the end too, that if we want to be able to scale some of this work, we need to be able to prove that it works, and I think works in many, many different ways. So as you heard from Helen and you heard on the last panel, we know something about the evidence from the installations and the efforts to date around caregiver interaction, around words spoken, you know, in terms of STEM and literacy and vocabulary. But we probably know a little bit less around those neighborhood level impacts, those community level impacts. So maybe start with Elliot and then pass it on to Nadia and Sarah. How can we really go about measuring those neighborhood level impacts? What should we be measuring? What's most important? Issues around crime came up or stress came up, valuation in spaces, all sorts of things that we can be measuring, but what's most appropriate to be measuring, and how do we do so in a way that really shows that beyond just the learning aspects, there's a whole other range of important outcomes that can come out of this work?
Yeah, I would say that we have been mostly focused on the change in that adult-child interaction. That has been the outcome goal, if you will, of much of this work. And the evaluation that's happened at the site level has been very compelling. The increases in both quantity and quality of interaction, variation of broader vocabulary, the kinds of collaboration and critical thinking that you want to see in interaction has been evidenced and documented at the sites. I think there's a question about the, if you could call it durability or transferability of those behaviors into other settings, right? That's also part of our goal. Not that it only happens at Urban Thinkscape or in the supermarket when prompted by the sign, but that it happens also when children and their caretakers go home or they're in other places in their communities where these bits of infrastructure or programming don't exist. And so I think we need to know a bit more about that first. Mm-hmm. So that's another frontier in research that is worthy of investigation, this question of transferability. The question of the neighborhood effects is another sort of frontier that we're trying to advance. Challenging for two reasons, I think. One is we don't yet have neighborhoods that have sufficient density, as Kathy mentioned, of opportunities so that families are meeting these things in lots of places and in sufficient number that you would expect to see a big change at the neighborhood level. So that's one challenge. The other is it's difficult to measure behavior change anyway on a broad level, and particular behaviors you're looking for to happen in the home, for example, right, to that question of transfer, the degree to which this transfers into the home. So those are some challenges in doing this, but I think there are also some emerging opportunities. We're in conversation currently, for example, with a number of community groups who are really interested in creating multiple opportunities within their small neighborhoods to create that kind of density of experience, and so evaluating that is one. Kaboom is in the process of doing a playful learning challenge in Philadelphia, and will create somewhere between 15 and 20 installations in neighborhoods around the city. There is the possibility that those exist in sufficient density as well to begin to measure neighborhood effects. And finally, we're looking at creating a citywide survey of adult-child interactions with the hopes that we'll be able to drill down deeply enough at the neighborhood level to understand or examine relationships between the patterns in adult-child interactions and the other investments that have been made in infrastructure, other playful learning opportunities by neighborhood or community. So I think some work to come on all of that, but it hasn't happened yet, really.
Yep. Nidhi, so of course, Project for Public Spaces does a lot of work in those spaces, and presumably tries to focus on, well, how do we know what all these varying efforts, knowing that they vary significantly across place, how do we know that they're working? What works best? How can you take some of those learnings and kind of transfer that into the playful learning landscapes kind of efforts to understand the extent to which they're having these neighborhood level impacts?
Right, so I will go to our kind of typical Project for Public Spaces approach to that, is that we look to combine the qualitative data with the quantitative data. So like really thinking about in a narrative way, in a storytelling manner, what are some of the qualitative benefits that people may be having that we may still be struggling to measure and quantify, because matrices are being developed, but as we do, let's look to some of the more sort of qualitative benefits. And then thinking about learning beyond the typical learning outcomes that people anticipate. So like thinking about community benefits, social cognition, cultural cognition, just being, how do you measure that kids who are growing up around these environments are not othering other people based on differences and like seeing the world more as a cohesive, diverse landscape. So really tuning into those social indicators, really tuning into those community indicators is where I would hope to go. And again, we're in a room full of people who understand matrices and are looking for evidence for this stuff. I'm sure we'll be able to get to some of those matrices as well. But I would, like I said, go beyond learning and go beyond kids, especially focusing on caregivers. How are, you know, their social indicators and their community life and their kind of achievements as they continue to grow as parents themselves, looking into those matrices as well.
Great, great. Is there anything to add on this issue of measurement and outcomes?
You know, as you both were thinking, it just made me think of how, you know, I mentioned that we haven't really done the research or analysis behind measuring the outcomes. However, in doing this work on the ground, there is a very noticeable outcome, which is pride of ownership, joy in playing. And this is something that we have 100% noticed through the work that we've done without doing any research behind it or having anyone sit there to measure what's happening interacting with the community members in Hazelwood where we're doing this work. There has been a significant shift. One of the play stops that we helped to create was Dilamato's Market is this small local grocery store. There's another term in communities called a food desert also. So Hazelwood did not have a grocery store. So anyway, there's a small grocery store. We did a play installation. I didn't personally, but we helped to put up a play installation on the front of the building. And in speaking with Diane, the business owner, she said, it has just brought so much joy to me and to our community members. They're playing with these, I'm happy to tell you more about it, magnetic fruit that goes on the a design on the front of the building. It's encouraging interaction between the caregivers and people who are coming to shop in the grocery store. They're playing as they come in. And then even in one of the green spaces that we helped to convert from a vacant lot to a play space for teens, it was vandalized very early on, right after we had a bunch of plantings put in. Within a week, a bunch of kids came in, ripped all the plants out, and were playing football with it. It broke my heart. However, the community really stepped up, and it brought me to tears to think about how they took ownership of this space because it was in their community, and they collected the plants for me. We were able to put them all back in the ground. They're still hopefully living, fingers crossed. But it really showed to me that there is buy-in from the community because this is doing something for them and for their community, and they feel ownership of it. They help to design it, they help to build it, and they're using it. And so really, for me, that is a measurable outcome, even though there has not been any documentation necessarily of it. It's more just in interacting.
Yeah.
I would like to add that in addition to like creative storytelling, also leaning to social media and the internet where possible, keeping in mind that not everybody has access to the devices, to the accounts and things like that, but wherever possible, trying to capture what people are already putting out there, giving them that Instagram moment or whatever, and then looking to those sort of softer measures as well, evidence wherever possible to kind of cohesively create a much stronger narrative and a better story.
And can I just add one more thing? You know, as we get smarter about this, the installations or the programming are really increasingly designed with specific learning outcomes in mind, right? And so if it's an art-focused or a science-focused either activity or installation, we're able to look at the extent to which children have assimilated those concepts after experiencing that installation or program. Increasingly, we have work being done in partnership with elementary schools so that the playgrounds that are being redesigned or rebuilt outside that school are being designed to complement specific learning objectives of the schools. And so we'll be watching to see whether those learning outcomes that are being measured at the school are improving at a higher rate thanks to the investment in this playful learning spaces that are being created. So not necessarily the neighborhood level yet, but at least an institutional level.
Sure. So as we, you know, at Brookings are thinking about, you know, we'll be really focused on building these networks, on really scaling this work, but we also know that it's not easy in communities, right? I think everybody here is enthusiastic about this idea. We know something about how it works, and we think it probably should be in more places and really be adopted more widely. but there are challenges. And Sarah, when we talked a few days ago prior to the panel, you raised some of this in your comments of saying, yeah, it's been a bit of a long road on some of these projects. Can you tell us sort of more about those challenges and what you found some of the barriers have been and how you've overcome them?
Sure, absolutely. And actually, this brings to mind a conversation that Nidhi and I were having earlier about the timeline for making this change. And I think you said it's 10 to 15 years oftentimes to see change come about. And so I think that, you know, the work of the Play Collaborative has been around for a long time, really pushing forward the effort of the Hazelwood Play Trail. While the idea is much older, the actual work really began about 2 years ago. And so one of the big projects that we had undertaken was to convert this vacant lot, which used to actually be, was called a tot lot. It was a small playground built in the 30s, decommissioned, and was an abandoned parking lot for a couple of decades. And so we had early on these conversations with city planning and with the Department of Public Works and the city of Pittsburgh around how to transform these spaces. And there was sort of this handshake agreement about what was going to happen with this city-owned property. And so we worked with a bunch of teens in the community to design it and brought in a design firm to actually do the design work. And in my mind, I stepped into this role and was like, oh, this is great. We've got the design drawings up. We have the agreement from the city. We're going to go ahead and move forward and turn this into a really beautiful event space. And what happened was that at the city level, there were some changes in the structure of the government, in that DPW, the Department of Public Works, was split into Department of Public Works and the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. I have no background in any of this. I'm on the ground, do the programming kind of person. And I stepped in and we had conversations about, okay, well, we need to raise the surface of the parking lot and re-asphalt it. Well, now that doesn't fall under DPW, that falls under DOMI. And so it started this whole other conversation with a new director and with a new entity that I had not had any interaction with who were not aware of this program. And so it was a really interesting learning curve to understand that sometimes these things take time. And it was very frustrating from my level. I was going to community meetings and talking about what was going to be happening and just kept hitting red tape after red tape. But I did find that, you know, if you just keep going forward and you can just keep talking to people, it can get done. But often, and especially with some of the continuing work that we've done along the play trail, it is finding the spaces to do the work and then understanding what needs to be put in place for sustainability. So for the example that I gave of the grocery store, the woman who owns the market, it's not her building. And so while she agreed to do the programming or have the installation put up, we had to then approach her, the building owner, and talk to him about what we were going to do with the space. A couple of the other locations that we had chosen with the community, it turned out that they didn't own the space themselves and they couldn't make that decision. And so while we wanted to be putting play along the way installations in the public realm, I got very gung-ho about bus stops and things like that. Those are things that there are barriers that are in place for good reason. I mean, when you're putting art out in the public realm, you have to be wary of what that art is saying and how that's going to affect people. But I think for us, one of the biggest challenges was really understanding how to reach out to the right entities to make the correct connections in order to make the work happen. And then the other thing is this idea of ownership, of the public feeling ownership, so that if something does happen, if there is vandalism that is occurring, that they are letting you know and that there are steps that are in place to help overcome that and work with that. And so I really have found that involving the community has made all of the difference because they want that space to be successful.
So you raise a lot of issues there around working with particularly public entities and, you know, turnover staff, working with different agencies at different points in the process. You raised issues around ownership. These, you know, when we talk about installations in the public realm, particularly, they're often going to be in public spaces that or non-public spaces that are owned by somebody else. How do you deal with that? And then you talked about other issues around ownership, which is partly around that community ownership and that maintenance over time. So Elliot and Nadine, you have, in your own work, have you run into similar or other barriers, and how have you dealt with them?
So I'll go first. Always barriers, obviously. Public spaces, there are like a bajillion entities that own all the small pieces of the things. So in the work that we do, we try to really, really hit hard on the point that let's first define who the community is and who the priority audiences in that community are. Priority obviously given to the more vulnerable, the more of a priority audience that becomes. And for children in marginalized communities, children in low-income communities, they kind of fit at the top of that priority audience. So really understanding whose life it is that needs to, you know, be transformed with them is the first, you know, order of business. And then once that community is defined, to then get to kind of the vision of change, like starting to visualize change. And by having a vision, it helps you be an advocate, because advocacy, by God, is hard and it takes a while. So arming yourself with that vision that can be used as an advocacy tool, but also visions are more flexible than physical designs and things. So it's continuing to lean into that flexibility and then looking for allies in the private and public realm all at the same time, because I know that our public entities are a little bit trapped in their silos. We're slowly getting out of that, but looking at unlikely allies in the public and private realm, and also understanding that social innovation really will happen at the intersection of the three sectors, the public, the private, and the for-purpose sector, which many of us are a part of. So continuing to think about how can we overlay all those three sectors together would be what would help us, and that's what has helped places. But again, it does take a while. It does take a lot of silo busting, but then keeping in mind that priority audience, that vision that they had, and staying flexible and nimble with that mission is what has allowed our communities, not us, because again, our communities do the work, has allowed them to be able to make the change.
And Elliot, I want to put a finer point on something that you just said. You know, when we talk about public, private, civic sectors, you know, part of this is getting them bought in, right, and bought into that vision so that they will be more supportive and hopefully are erecting fewer barriers in the process. So, you know, this whole idea around playful learning landscapes is this fusion, right, between learning and play and public spaces. So, Elliot, to what extent have you found that fusion, particularly that integration of the learning into play, where maybe it's harder to get in a limited, you know, in environments of limited resources, if it's harder to get that support over play alone, how much has that infusion of the learning really helped maybe get more, you know, buy-in or more traction among Philadelphia leaders so that you can get some of these projects done?
Yeah, I think the integration, the intersectionality of that has been essential to the traction that it's gotten and the momentum it's gotten in Philadelphia, because in some ways it's been able to attach itself to other efforts that already have momentum. And I think that's a key. So we have a local campaign for grade level reading, and I know later Ralph Smith will talk a little bit about that, but we call it Read by Fourth in Philadelphia. It's all about engaging adults and children in order to increase reading proficiency. And as they think about opportunities to do that, playful learning, the learning piece, fits exactly in with that larger effort that's already involving 100 organizations across the city. And so this layered on top of that has given it great momentum. And similarly, as communities think about revitalizing and restoring play opportunities for kids, which is an area that has suffered from terrible underinvestment over decades in Philadelphia, they're really looking to maximize the benefits that kids can get from those new investments that are coming in. So the new play space, that yes, it can be fun for kids. Yes, it can give them physical exercise and opportunity. It can also build their early learning skills. Communities get that. Neighborhood, you know, groups understand that this is an added advantage for a minimal additional investment that can be offered to their children, and have really embraced it, right? We like to use super simple examples. If you want a sliding board and there's going to be a ladder, put numbers next to each of those steps, or put colors on each of those steps, and you spark conversation among children or between children and adults that wouldn't have happened otherwise if those very small subtle prompts weren't incorporated into the design. And so sharing that with community groups, with city leaders, has been really key. Look, it's no secret that early language and early literacy is a huge challenge in our cities. And in Philadelphia, that's definitely true. And so anything that can be done to move that needle forward while also meeting the other needs of community members and residents is has been really embraced.
Great. Well, this has been great, and I want to make sure that we leave some time for all of you to ask questions of our panel. So Karen has the mic. Anyone? Lots of people. Great. Point. I'm going to start here.
Thank you. Jerry Wind, Reimagine Education Program. A quick question on the measurement. Have you done any measurement on the impact on the adults learning? We heard about the impact on the kids. What about the impact on the parent or the others involved in the learning process?
Thank you. Yeah, I would just say that some of the evaluation work that we've done has included both observation, right? It's change in adult behavior. So that's sort of the best demonstration of adult learning in some ways is the way they're interacting with their children. We've also done qualitative and survey work following some of the experiences, both programmatic and installation, where the adults have shared their takeaways from that experience. And so that's some of the evidence that we have emerging from this work.
Great. All right, we're going to do a couple at once. Let's see, we'll go here and then right behind, and we'll go down the line on this side of the room.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Ankita Chachra from NACTO's Global Designing Cities Initiative. We've been working on a program called Streets for Kids and really looking at cities from the place-based perspective of how do you design cities that work for children and caregivers, not only from safety, but also from education. And I know Kathy was a part of our advisory board on the publication that we just did. And one of the challenges that we're facing now as we're really implementing some of these designs is that the data that we've been collecting and the measurement is very place-based, whereas what you're really looking at impact is a larger conversation. And I'm curious if anyone here in the audience has any guidance or is running into similar issues where, you know, when you're looking at a place and you're talking about social interactions taking place in a particular plaza or a public space, how does that relate to childhood development on a greater impact? And if anyone can make that connection, please find me. I'm looking for answers
okay.
here.
All right. Space versus wider impacts.
Okay. Hi, I'm Laura Huerta Maigas from the Association of Children's Museums. We have your answers. representing more than 300 children's museums in a field that have been building these spaces for over 120 years, and the talk about scale in this environment, there's been a lot of talk about relationship building, but I'm very interested in a very practical any trends that people are aware of in practical matters around some of these challenges are also about codes and approvals for building codes and permitting. These are the kinds of things that our built environments struggle with all the time. Are you a playground? Are you a public open space? Is a water feature a pool? So how do we, and those are very specific conversations that are not child-centered. So I'm interested in conversations about how you make those conversations with your local officials child-centered for these developments and to promote scale.
Okay. Scaling and barriers around just codes and other very practical matters. And we'll take one more over here, and then I'll turn it back to the panel. Yep.
Hello, I'm Tony Bloom with USAID. I'm curious where technology plays a role in this. I mean, I think of kids being isolated, and you don't want that. But I also think about the craze with Pokemon Go that got my kids out in the community. And just curious if you've seen appropriate uses of technology that weave its way within the playful learning landscape vision that you have.
Okay, great.
So I'll start in terms of the codes and the mandates and planning manuals and zoning. This is more a call out to all the advocates in the room and others who might be listening on our Twitterverse. We need to be breaking down a lot of those barriers. So thinking about, again, how our civic agencies work and how they can be reformed is a cause that we should all be putting our weight behind. I personally am getting more and more engaged in that. We need fewer agencies, but we do need an agency for public space that can kind of really talk about the priority audience and that can act as the central body that brings a lot of the different agencies together. We've had these silos for far too long, and in a time where in some ways conversation has become easy and other ways more segmented, we really have to be thinking about agencies that can actually allow for that seamless thinking, just like seamlessly we experience the public realm. So kind of mimicking how we experience the public realm, our agency should be similar to that. Another advocacy push, this is again, I have the mic, so I'll tell the world this is what we need to do, changing the perception of childhood well-being and really decoupling that from the playground. Because so thinking about how do we create the kind of interaction and joy that kids experience in the playground? How do we create that everywhere else in the city that they need to be? And my mind immediately goes to kids being strapped in car seats and sitting behind and until they get to that playground, not experiencing any joy or movement. So how do we kind of change that perception? And then how do we make the city play for all adults? So play for adults and interaction for kids everywhere else. And about technology, I think my answer would be how do we make technology more communal? So things that you can experience together instead of on a singular device. So interactive larger screens that require more than one person to play almost. That's kind of where we should be thinking about, because one of the reasons that kids are so attached to their devices and the screens, there's nothing else to look at. So how do we create that leverage technology for communal benefit and interaction, and hopefully interaction with people from who are slightly different from us?
Yeah, getting adults out of their screens as well, not just the kids.
I want to add to the scalability and the overcoming the boundaries, the barriers that are in place. So something that we've noticed is really getting in touch with your local council people, for one, has really been helpful for us, especially in Hazelwood, in helping to, they can help push forth initiatives on your behalf. And really it's about making those correct connections. So we also have, myself and a coworker oversee a recess advocacy team, and we look at recess policy on the one hand, but also just recess in general, and looking at all of the different states that are looking at recess. And to tie this back in, it's about making the connection with the people who can push forth, whether that's caregivers and parents, educators, legislators, council people. They are the ones that can help you take the work that you're doing to the next level, help you rethink. You know, if you're trying to work in a public space and there's all sorts of red tape, their community members are talking to them about what they want and why they want it, and they're going to want to help you put forth something that is going to be fun and playful for the community. So really, making those connections and making sure that the right people are hearing about the work that you're doing and understanding why it's important to them. I mean, I think even for the recess team, the legislator that we've been talking to, he has kids in school who were not experiencing recess. And so he has a vested interest in pushing for more play within schools.
Quick last word by Elliot.
Just, I would commend Jenny Perlman Robinson's report to you on this issue of scaling. Exactly, she calls it forging key alliances as being one of the essential challenges in bringing this to scale. And we think about it in three ways. Rebecca sort of alluded to this earlier. One is making the science available to those people who make the decisions about code and installations. Two is creating some existence proofs. Urban Thinkscape that you saw earlier played a key role in that. It's actually built on private land because of some of the code issues, but it is the existence proof that other people can come and see. And third is making the explicit connection between the opportunity this creates and the explicit goals of that organization or city department. And so we're sort of thinking about doing all three of those things at once in order to bring this to a greater scale.
Great. Well, thank you so much to all of you. This has been great. I know I learned a lot. I think you hopefully all learned a lot as well. So I'm going to move forward. I have the greatest pleasure to be able to introduce our keynote speaker for today, Frances Brunett. Frances became the Pratt Institute in New York's 12th president in January of 2018. Before coming to Pratt, she served as the senior vice president and provost at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago, and she's held a lot of other university leadership roles along the way. For more than two decades, Brunett has been developing and publishing work on multidisciplinary design curricula connecting fields like architecture and engineering and science and technology and humanities, social sciences, and the arts. She's received extensive funding for a lot of this work, has published widely on it, and we're really just grateful for the opportunity to hear her discuss her innovative approaches and work around the connections between education and learning and place and design. So please, let's give a warm welcome to Frances.
actually means go.
Ah, there we
all right. So thank you very much. Thank you to Helen and your entire team, because I know it takes 1,000 hands to make anything work. And so I really appreciate being here. I always, in my trajectory, in my own journey, every time I come to a completely new audience, I think, why didn't I know about that discipline? And I probably would have been amongst you. So I'm absolutely delighted to be here. And although you just heard that I'm a president, which is a university's chief executive officer, responsible for the success of our students, our faculty, our leadership, my own research work actually sits in the domain of design, space, and play. I'm going to present in two arenas. One through the lens of my early life. As a child, I was a first-generation latchkey kid in inner-city Montreal, often out in the streets without a designated caregiver. So the projects here cultivated an interest for me on that level. Two, I'll be describing the experimental work I've done with action artists, including children, that have deep parallels with playful learning landscapes. So here we are at Pratt Institute. I'm very proud to say that Nidhi is actually a faculty member at Pratt Institute. And so the very work that she does in looking at environments is part of our entire curriculum. I'm not actually going to talk about that, although I could spend much of the day on it. So I'm from a family of and neighborhood of working class Holocaust survivor immigrants in urban Montreal. I grew up believing I spent all of my time outside in the streets. And of course, it was Canada, and I forgot the 7 months of winter where I played indoors at Neighborhood House, a stripped-down set of rooms above a grocery store. And only last year, as I'm kind of going through what was my life like, I discovered that the place I hung out was, and I quote, Neighborhood House was set up to keep immigrant adolescents off the street, assist their integration into the community, combat a pervasive problem of juvenile delinquency, and serve as a social, educational, cultural, and recreational center for children in the area. So apparently, problems of delinquency for my group were disproportionate to my community's population, attributed to the substandard parenting of immigrant parents. Neighborhood House provided youth with a refuge to avert antisocial tendencies. It had a lending library, as well as art classes. Membership included multiple first-generation communities. I had no idea it had dedicated caseworkers and staff who invested much time and energy there, recognizing their responsibility for shaping future citizens. What I knew is I went there after school with little obvious supervision. Dance was our common language. We had very limited resources. We depended on each other as friends, supporters, turf warriors, to be brave in the world. Fast forward many, many years. I had graduated from two professional schools. I'm an engineer and an architect. I also did a business degree. I worked in practice, building moderate income housing, women's centers, mixed-use urban projects. I taught at night from tech programs with students of all ages, learning how to learn to do construction documents, to teaching design studios at McGill. Indeed, I would spend my future life working across boundaries. I used physical projects to connect action artists, contractors, engineers, architects, musicians, designers. So after grad school in architecture, as a faculty member at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, upstate New York, I was working with architecture students who, although making and building was part of their DNA, they did this at very small scales, different kind of scales than you were talking about a minute ago, and often abstracted. I saw my students didn't actually understand that what they were building in eighth scale drawings, little drawings, what it meant to full scale space or even models. So we started to design full scale installations in order to extrapolate without drawings and models what it meant when you blew them up to human scale. It's not something we do in architecture schools. We do little models because we don't have the resources to build full scale all the time. Well, something happened along the way. My dance life entered the studio. That's how I connected cultures earlier, so I was very comfortable in that arena. We began designing performance projects wrapped around an abbreviated model of design build. The full-scale project is hands-on. The shift from visual, which is often what we're doing in architecture, to bodily determination, where collaboration creates mutual movement and students and performers refer to each other. Very similar to the community-based work we've been talking about. There is very, very different learning that goes on when it moves from the visual to the visceral, from the drawn to the haptic. When we built these spaces in the school studio, in abandoned stores, in the city, we invited action artists to occupy them. This included anyone from skateboarders to rogue running children. Rogue running children, is I think what I was called. Rogue running child. The dancers and the athletes began to explore the potentials of space, seeing how we engage with each other and the space itself. They would indeed be considered playful learning landscapes if we had any data on what learning actually occurred. But knowing what you're doing here, we could have had a whole other way of investigating. What were the interactions? Did this offer opportunities otherwise impossible elsewhere? We were also transforming underutilized space. Let's see if I can make this video go.
The boy who swings from rope to horse, leaping back again to the swinging rope, is learning by his eyes, muscles, joints, and by every sense organ he has to judge, to estimate, to know. The other 29 boys and girls in the gym are all as active as he, some of them in his immediate vicinity. But as he swings, he does not avoid. He swings where there is space. A very important distinction. And in doing so, he threads his way among his 29 fellows. Using all his facilities, he is aware of the total situation in that gym, of his own swinging, and of his fellows' actions. If the room were cleared and 29 boys and girls sat at the side silent while he swung, we should in effect be saying to him, to his legs, body, eyes, be as egotistical as you like. If the swinging boy actually wonders about his choice of where to swing, of where there is space, he will invariably miss it. Neither the contact improvisation dancer nor the swinging boy can afford to be wrong.
So these are everything we were doing here at some level was precarious. You might call it risky recreation, ultimately transformed into guided player performance through rehearsal and learning about each other's bodies. I love your language, adult initiated, child directed, community initiated, not much different than a choreographer, constructor, and the invitation to dancers to play and communicate. In the next projects that I will describe, Beating a Path and Spill Out, we constructed or evolved space.
The transgression of the cutting through the floor. No theater will let you cut their floor. I've asked several times, they don't let you. I've got a chainsaw, can I cut your floor? So the fact that you did that and got that all together, and the fact that every time you went down, it would probably be different, and there'd probably be an infinite number of ways, not quite, but almost, that you could get from up to down, or from down to up, and directionally it was interesting.
Do you feel like it confuses where you are in space, like as a non-mover watching the movers? Do you feel like you all of a sudden get transformed in terms of your where, the where of you?
I think in this piece right here, the inner tube piece, I almost fell down when I was downstairs. I was watching the thing and moving around, and then at one point, somebody bumped into me, and I thought I had actually grabbed onto them for support. I was transferring what I was doing onto what I was seeing, another dancer.
Cool.
So evolved space, I call space in the making, generated by the movements of action artists. These projects act as pilots for long-standing space for ordinary inhabitation. So in the proposals, dancers and architects offer an alternative to ready-made space. Space in the making borrows from Bruno Latour's concept of ready-made science versus science in the making. Latour asks whether the profile of an experiment and its outcome will change based on its context. In our situation, context, in this case, the very players or inhabitants, has an opportunity to change the space. So space in the making sets up a model for designing where we don't have a predetermined set of anything, drawings, a way of assembling things, or the way that people have to occupy it. This is a ready-made space that you're in. You walked in, you knew exactly what to do, you sat down. There isn't a lot of play in here. That means that any physical construction that you would make would not be based on a preconceived generic idea about the context, the project, the occupants. Space in the making allows designers to work intimately with the situation at hand, and the design emerges from that specific, full-scale, and particular situation. It includes the physical and cultural context, interactions with the users. Interestingly enough, I didn't know when to say this, but I looked at my drawing, and this is bizarre, okay, because it just didn't even enter my mind. But I did double Dutch skipping. And I think about it now with you'll see when with my work. And what does double Dutch skipping do? It's so many things. It's finding the place where the space exists. You have to anticipate the space. It's not there yet. Those of you who play football know you're always going to the open space. And of course, it has fundamental math in it, science, distance equals rate times time, right? When do I jump? When is the opening? Not to mention the sinusoidal curves that are there. We can go on and on. But most importantly for me, it was about the complex human interactions. When do you jump? Who's managing this? Who's talking? It's a lot of paying attention to the particular context. So this is what working with a community would do to actually design the creative landscapes, but would be redefined by the very movement of the people who may not be as predictable. Maybe a new group shows up from different kinds of relationships to different kinds of bodies and proclivities. Both Beating a Path and Spill Out demonstrate the extreme possibility of designing in movement and creating through the making, where the space of construction and inhabitation can't be fully determined without that movement, without face-to-face interaction. They set up ambiguous liminal conditions. So three conditions have to be met. One, the design and construction is based on who and what is there. Two, the space must emerge concurrently from that specific context, the way the dancers move, the container in which the elements are placed, while both the space and the dance iteratively unfold. And three, even in the final performance, which ultimately is crafted for an audience to look at, possibilities of how each audience member can view or understand the whole can be different. Of course, the work that you see here is truly space in the making, a part of embodied learning where children are learning with their whole bodies. Our projects began with placing found objects in a space of rehearsal, and it didn't matter what we started with. So here we're used materials we literally found in the street, in the alley, to begin play in an abandoned storefront. A sewer pipe and a piece of plywood transformed into a wheeled glass floor. How do we design space like a path that emerges over time, like the trampling of bushes by human occupation? So you know that when you crash through bushes, if you all crash through them, we'd actually have a path, we'd beat a path. But if we stopped doing it, that path would go away and would close up. So this is always about, how does this thing evolve over time? So in our case, we looked at multiple kinds of materials. The vertical surface of the spandex registered the body in movement. Without the pressure of the dancer, the material reverted back to its taut first condition. And when one dancer pushed in, the other would be pushed back. Later on, we'll talk about a trampoline kind of punch the jump condition, which is a term for a wrongly timed landing that propels two bodies into unexpected trajectories. This concept will emerge many times. The rolling platforms operated in the most extreme way. When the dancers moved the platforms, they pushed into the standing audience, and the spectators had to be conscious of where the platforms were and when. The onus was on the audience to move out of the way, otherwise they were going to get hit. The audience was a part of the performance. Space was made by the audience moving. When the dancers ran in one direction on the rolling glass floors, they are part of Newton's third law of physics. To every action, there is always an equal and opposite reaction. Hence, the performers move in one direction on a rolling platform. The floors move in the opposite direction. That means an audience intently watching the performers run and the dancers are running away from them, might miss that the floor, which is a glass edge, is on a collision course with their shins. So these projects clearly had us looking at how each can contribute to the making of space, a context, and a community. This was a continuum. There was no disjunction between how the bodies interact. How can we perform and thrive in constantly shifting ecosystems? How do we build trust, a shared language? How do we teach capacity for adaptive work? Sarah Hedren asks us to be a public, she asks us, be a public amateur. Consent to learn in public outside of one's discipline. By the way, that is owning imposter syndrome. I just want to say, it never goes away. But if we say that we're working in domains that are not our own, then we are asking the same questions we ask our children to ask every day. In Spillout, so this is a great line by Herbert Simon, if you don't know it, everyone designs who devises courses of action aimed at changing existing conditions into preferred ones. In Spillout, we built a structure where the bodies were dependent upon each other to not be thrust out. It, in this case, was a vertical trampoline. Each dancer had to be aware of the force and movement of each other dancer. Each performer had to be aware of the elasticity of the 10,000 bands that wrap the structure. These spandex bands only had so much elastic capacity, and the elastic wall may have been too taut or too loose, with strands too far or too close. The dancers' engagement with the elements in full scale in real time showed the designers how dancers had to always relate to each other and to the structure. In every iteration, the physical frameworks changed as the dancers became more familiar with the elements and as the elements became more tuned to the bodies of both the performers and the body of each emerging phase. The goal was to have an installation that was both architecturally rigorous and stunning while allowing the dancers to have a myriad of ways to perform so that it always evolved, so they could be viewed, inspired, and supported by the installation. And this goes back to the choreographer, architect initiated, dancer directed. The dancers know their own bodies. They worked using their skills and the learning curve of the structure. And finally, the configuration was a 40 foot long, 12 foot high, 2.5 foot wide steel scaffold like structure covered with thousands of spandex strips in a 19th century red brick gas holder building, 100 feet in diameter and 50 feet high. So it evolved. We started with a little structure covered in rubber bands, a surface doomed to snap and catch on skin and hair and deteriorate over time in light, all conditions that could have been the foundation of a very powerful performance, but less likely to survive the normative demands of rehearsal overuse. So the final evolution revealed a number of ways to see, use, and experience the performance. It could be seen as a solid when lit from outside in the earlier slides, and the dancers were rendered invisible, or it could be pulled apart, stretched for the dancers to emerge or retreat. Over a long period of time, the spandex became plastic, losing some of its elasticity. and the dance itself had to shift, accommodating the material changes. And the dancers, of course, always have to be aware of how their bodies are interacting with materials to take advantage of the fluctuations, both subtle and dramatic. And when sealed inside, the light thrown from one end of the wall could create a complete and distinct set of performances from cast shadows on the cylindrical interior surface of the Gasholder House. Ultimately, the viewer could see the work multiple times and have a completely different experience each time. In fact, the dancers had a continuously different experience as well. One viewing may be concentrated only on the shadows, another could engage sections of the spandex wall, another could see the entire scaffold, or there could be combinations of all of them. It's unlikely that anyone could get it all at once. This is indeed the point. As a space in the making as opposed to ready-made space. Nothing could be seen at once. Both the dancers and the audience had multiple modes of experiencing the performance. That means when you're installing anything, you want to make sure people come back over and over because the experience changes for them every single time. Okay, let's see if I can make this one go. Wow. Okay, so you're going to have to go with me on this. These dancers are actually projecting their bodies against the spandex, and they could propel each other out if they're not paying attention to both the elastic and where the other person is located. So they're actually dancing in sync, so that it's really critical to be aware of the community on the wall. In this case, as I mentioned, the elastic becomes plastic and yielding, and then brittle, and actually could break. You know, like an elastic pair of old running shorts. The performance changed daily. With less aggressive gestures, the bands yielded more readily. You had to know what your partner was doing. It was a felt knowing. How hard could you go by sensing the tension in the performance? We took this another step. In every city I worked, I found the best local dance company. In Eugene, it was Danceability, a mixed abilities dance company. At the same time, as I had two jobs. I was the dean of the school, but I was also doing this program. My day job, I was launching an adaptive athletes section of our product design program. And the two programs looked at human ability and variability very differently. One, like many prosthetic biomedical engineering programs, see the variability as an opportunity for a fix, for therapy, for a cure. Danceability sees variability as a celebration of difference. This contested territory is the place we want to be. There is a tension between Sarah Hedren's practical, functional, use-based, efficient model versus the performative, the poetic, the uncertain. So in Wounded Warrior's product design course, we took aspiring Paralympians and built prosthetics for them, fixing the body, in fact, making them superhuman. In the dance, Don't Leave Me, we went back to the model of ultimately we're all connected and depends on who shows up, an opportunity that Susan Segal of Mobility International calls an infiltration of difference. In order to do the project in movement, it meant building at full scale and in real time. Hence, we work with whoever shows up for rehearsal, pushing that the dancers had to be there for every built experiment. The space of the project emerged from the specific context, the very people rehearsing, and the particular objects or space we were playing with. while the spaces and the dance iteratively unfolded. We officially met twice a week for our class in an abandoned warehouse. We were up, you know, there's a lot of abandoned warehouses in every town you can imagine. The dancers didn't have rehearsals in between because it was very exhausting for them as dancers with disabilities. We had to really program when they could be performing. But the architects met regularly because building actually takes much more time than moving your body. Well, let's see if this rule, somehow this is not videotaping going. So without a leg and missing a pelvis, Karen could fold up into a very small shape. The cubes that ultimately got designed got smaller and smaller. The height became a walker level for Karen, the interior a small house. We anticipated applying our discoveries to the other occupants, not fully understanding that most adults can't fold their bodies the way Karen could. Our tests were movement-driven. The cubes and how they were used were repeatedly reordered, and their size and use redefined each time the dancers encountered them. In one seminal experiment, a few dancers stacked a set of cubes and then climbed into them. It became clear that top-loading the cubes would cause them to fall over. One dancer, close to the top, felt the cubes wobble and cried out, "Don't leave me." That became the basis for the section. The structure was only stable if the dancers held it together with their hands and by locating their bodies to shift the weight. This is real technology, by the way, of understanding forces through a structure. We seized the invention. We spent the next weeks determining how high we could go and how thin the frames could be. By using their bodies as part of the architecture, the dancers had to constantly be evaluating how to use their bodies to stabilize the project. This type of construction is time-consuming. It relies on continuous observation of the dancers by the architects, by continuous evaluation of the dancers, of how their bodies are reacting to the elements, and on rapid build-out and prototyping between rehearsals. I wonder if this is our database. But more significantly, the body can adapt much more quickly to the physical context than the physical context can adapt to us. This means the dancers can change a movement in a moment, and the constructors will have to set design and assembly times to accommodate that body shift. Time is critical, and it may make more sense that many times for the body to rethink the movement than the environment to change. The structure was only stable if the dancers held it together with their hands and by locating their bodies and shifting weight. How high could we go? The collective musculatures were totally part of the architecture. If you leave me, I will topple. As the shapes became more unstable and unpredictable, the dancers paid more attention. They became more in sync with the environment that seemed to continually be under construction. The dancers had to adjust to the forces in the wood, and the space was transformed by this careful shift. These transient visceral environments are an immediate physical arena where mutual trust, understanding of each other, scale, and community are omnipresent. If one element, one hand grip fails, another hand muscle must compensate, or the community is in danger. The overall dissolves. Beating a path and don't leave me represent connections and the mapping of our physical and architectural bodies together. If we can't feel the force that we exert on each other, sometimes but just leaning on your next door neighbor or through the vehicle of an unstable structure, then there's failure. Success depends on both the individual and the community in respected relationships. Rely on the team. Thank you. And now I'd like to call Ralph Smith from the Campaign for Grade Level Reading to the stage for closing remarks. Thank you.
Good morning. I was fully prepared to own the imposter title. Absolutely fully prepared to embrace it. And then I realized that actually I should embrace being a public amateur. you know, the legend of favors that brings me here had a whole lot to do with how much I owe Kathy. And she can collect for the next 10 years, and I would still be ahead. But what Kathy didn't tell me is that in the audience today would be the greatest provocateur I know, and that's Barry Zuckerman. She didn't tell me that because it is truly intimidating to be any place. And having to look out and look at Barry Zuckerman. And if those of you who don't know, actually, Barry, I see you were elevated because you were called a gentleman earlier. And I've never heard that, but I assume that you appreciated it. My task is, first of all, to ask everybody to find this card. And trust me, I don't have a game for you, so don't. The organizers of today's event have a serious interest in continuing the conversation. This is not intended as a one-off, and they are inviting and encouraging everyone here to take seriously their invitation to share the question you would have asked had we more time, the comment you would have made, the issue that you believe that we left uncovered or underattended, and any critique or suggestions you may have about further work. This is a really serious invitation, so make good use of this card. And as you do so, I'm hoping that some of you will take seriously this aspiration to build a global movement. And because of that aspiration, look more critically at this commitment to find the evidence and to codify the elements. Because in those two, there is the possibility that the potential for disruption could easily be lost. And so whenever I hear find the evidence and codify the elements, that tells me to be especially cautious, especially attentive and vigilant. Because those two run the potential of recreating what we have and losing the disruptive creativity that is the promise of this incipient and emerging movement. You know, there's a sort of a transformative potential in this notion that we ought to acknowledge that children are hardwired for learning. And so every time somebody says we need to get children ready to learn, you know, that's a sort of an oxymoron that really is amusing if people didn't take it so seriously. Children are hardwired for learning. The question is, are we prepared to enable, encourage, and expand the opportunity for learning? That's the challenge that this movement is taking on. And it's taking it on by looking at the larger environment, by looking at the built environment, by hearkening back to the wonderful literature about third places and recreating this notion that there are places and spaces where community happens. And in those places and spaces, we have this opportunity to promote a vastly enriched and expanded notion of learning. And I know we're 5 minutes and 24 seconds past our promised time. And some of you may know I'm a lawyer and are sitting down there saying, lawyers speak in 40-minute sound bites, so we've got another half hour to go. let me cut to the. You know, there really is something quite special here, this notion that you can close the gap between the science and the practice, this notion that place and learning are not independent. In fact, they're codependent, and we need to acknowledge that. But coming from the standpoint of the campaign for grade level reading, and I really appreciate the shout out, Elliot, there's one particular aspect of this that I'd like to lift up. You know, there are many of us who like children a whole lot more than we like adults. I'm among them, right? And when we commit learning to schools, we essentially commit learning to people who have chosen to spend their time with children and not adults. We have committed learning to a professional institution that is all about kids and that is populated by people who share what a lot of us have, a deep suspicion of parents, especially low-income parents. And there are many of us, if we really admit it, believe that many of these parents are where they are because they've made bad choices and bad judgments on their own lives and ought not fully to be trusted to make good decisions for their children. And we build institutions to essentially mitigate the possibility that they'll mess up their kids because we can take care of them for 20% of the time. By expanding the learning zone and the learning opportunity, we create the possibility that even as we seek to transform schools and make them more welcoming to parents and families, that we can have in communities places and spaces where parents don't have to knock down the doors. In fact, they may not even have to knock on the doors. Where parents can go with their kids and can feel some sense of agency and can feel a sense of efficacy in dealing with their kids. Spaces and places where we can practice what we're now coming to understand as relational health. And it's a kind of an opportunity for an authentic practice. And places and spaces which, if we do it right, can shorten the century plus that Rebecca scared the hell out of us by saying it would take to close the gap between the poor. We ought to be intentional about saying part of the reason why we're doing this is to increase the likelihood that as these children learn more about themselves, more about the world, as they're embraced by stronger communities, that these children may have improved prospects of grasping that first rung on the ladder of the success sequence. And here at Brookings, we ought to have the success sequence in mind. And we ought to be able to say loudly that if we do this right, These children should stand a better chance of graduating from high school, and they should stand a better chance of graduating from high school because they'll have a better chance of experiencing early school success, and they'll have a better chance of early school success because they'll have more interactive and joyful childhoods in the company and in the care of their parents and of the communities in which they live. That's the potential of this work, and it seems to me it's a wonderful cause. It's a great opportunity, and I just want to congratulate all the folks we heard here today and the folks who are involved in supporting this movement. This is great work. I'm pleased to be in any way associated with it. I thank Kathy and Roberta for allowing me to tag along, and I wish you well. And that's a wrap.